we do have things like the truth and facts on our side. We just don't do what's necessary to push the other side's disinfo back off the battlefield and into the fringes where it belongs and where it's operated for most of history.
Hello, this is the Great Battlefield Podcast. I'm Nathaniel G. Perlman. A great political battle is being fought right now between progressives and the forces of reaction on the other side. This show is about the political entrepreneurs and other progressive leaders who are finding new or improved ways to fight. David Goldstein is founder and chief strategist of We Defend Truth, a group dedicated to defending our democracy through work in the digital realm, countering disinformation, by first understanding how the other side spreads it. I asked David about his career in political campaigning, polling, and content marketing, and how that led to tackling the disinformation problem and what he's learned in that arena. David is a good guest. You should listen. So, after a quick word from my sponsor, my interview with David Goldstein of We Defend Truth.
This episode is brought to you by Graphicacy. Graphicacy is an analytic design firm that can help you advance the mission of your organization using your own real data and information. They are 21st century visual communicators who create interactive graphics, motion graphics, and data visualizations. You can find Graphicacy at graphicacy.com. That is GRAPHICACY.com. With Graphicacy's help, you can visualize a better world.
David, would you mind introducing yourself and giving me a quick biography?
Of course. My name is David Goldstein. I am co-founder of We Defend Truth, which is dedicated to the fight against disinformation. I have been a longtime political operative. I've worked about 20 years on a variety of campaigns, local, national, all over the world. I got interested, like so many other people, in disinformation after 2016, when I could see that there was something that I considered very new under the sun in the wake of Brexit and Trump's victory. So what I dedicated myself to over the past few years is identifying what has worked for the other side. What do the disinfo guys do really, really well? And what can we learn from that? Using that knowledge, how can we then respond to it in an effective way that can scale? So that's been my focus, and that's what I've dedicated myself to, I think, with some success.
That is really an area where we need help these days. And so I'm pretty glad you're working on it. I came across your work, I think, for the first time reading this book, The Lie Detectives. I kind of honor all the people who got featured in that and those who didn't that are working on this stuff. I want to talk to you a little bit first about your career and how you got yourself into this important place. Can you tell me a little bit about how you grew up and your education?
Yeah, of course. I grew up in Kansas, which immediately kind of made me an unusual person for this work because I was an unusual person there. My father is Jewish from Boston. My mother is actually from Sri Lanka. So to grow up, I think, in a very kind of suburban rural area like Kansas, which was almost uniformly very white and evangelical, I always made me different from what was going on around me in what I think is a really positive way. Originally, I studied to be a singer. I was intending to be an opera singer, but I got cancer in my spinal cord about my third year of college. And in recovering from that, I decided to come out to New York to see what other opportunities, what else I could do that was either adjacent to music or something else entirely. And what wound up happening is one of my closest friends from Kansas was out here as well. And she was dating a political consultant. And he and I just got along like gangbusters. And politics had always been a secondary hobby, passion to music for me. So I loved what he was doing and the kind of work he was up to. And I asked what degree I needed to do what he does. And he was basically like, well, you just have to be willing to work hard and write well. And I was like, well, I think I can do both of those. And so he was extraordinary in that he called up his former firm and they had a spot on their research team. And I took it. And so I was trained in all the kind of traditional quantitative and qualitative methodologies. And that's was pretty much what my career was at the start.
What was that group?
The whole thing was run by a guy named Ed Reilly, who had been a pollster for Michael Dukakis and Dick Gephardt and then John Kerry. And it was called Westhill, but then he had sold it to a bigger firm called FD, and then FD sold itself to an even bigger firm called FTI Consulting. You know, traditionally one fish eating another fish, but we had this small core political group kind of within that corporate structure that I was a part of.
Cool. That seems like an interesting entry into politics. What was the next job after that?
I found I could do some of the political work almost as a freelancer because of the contacts that I made there. And I was interested to see what else you could do from kind of the research and consulting area. So I worked for a while with an education and media group, which wound up being really important because I got to see what the impact of technology could be. This was like 2008, 2009, and a lot of people were exploring the impact of technology, essentially on the human mind. Of course, we were looking at students, but it really started to give me an appreciation for how quickly things were changing in terms of media and what that meant. So I then went to work for Joel Benenson, who was Obama's pollster for a few years.
Yeah, I want to ask you about that because I have never talked to Joel. I've heard positive things about him. What was your impression of him in that firm?
Well, I got very lucky, I think. What was really unique about Joel is Joel has such an unconventional background as well. You know, he actually came out of the theater world. He had a bunch of crazy jobs. There was a while where he was like selling knives in bars. You know? But what he had dedicated himself to directly before he got into politics was journalism. So again, it was this very strong writing culture, which I couldn't have appreciated more because that's always been a talent for me and something I've enjoyed doing. But Joel was the classical, very super intense, extremely demanding, but very high quality output kind of boss. It was that movie that came out a while ago where it was about the drummer and his teacher was screaming at him all the time and people thought that was such a horrible thing. But then at the end of the movie, the student achieves mastery. And I always thought that was a happy story. I had that kind of same attitude towards Joel, where Joel could scream, Joel could yell, Joel could insult, but you couldn't argue with how much better of an analyst and writer that he could make out of you if you could get through it.
I didn't know that about him. That's kind of a mixed blessing, it sounds like.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things. I think a lot of those guys are like that. I saw that also with Ed Reilly, and I've heard the same stories about guys like Mark Penn and folks like that. They have that big, bombastic, hugely demanding personality. But, you know, if you can put your nose to the grindstone and realize that you're becoming better at what you want to dedicate your life to, it's a really fortunate situation to be in. I think our generation's changing that a little bit. I've talked to a lot of my colleagues who came up around the same time. None of us are kind of that way anymore with our kind of young people. And it's a question whether or not our junior folks are missing out on something because we're not as screamy, you know, when we're working with them. I look back on that very fondly, and I'm really happy for the time I got to have him as a mentor and as a guide.
It is interesting. There's a lot of different ways to lead effectively, not just what maybe we think of right now as the most enlightened, but other ways work well historically.
No, I think you're totally right. I had a long conversation at one point about this young person I was mentoring, and he was like, you know, I'm jealous of what you guys kind of had because he flat out said, am I too coddled to ever be great at what I'm doing? And I was like, you know, that's a fantastic question. I was like, there are people who I know who are way better than me at this and who did have a very nurturing, very supportive environment. So I'm not sure. And obviously for me, when I mentor somebody, I tend to be much more understanding and patient. For me, the jury's still out. I have my way of teaching, but I also understand that it's not the way I learned.
Well, I suspect that different types of bosses are better fits for different types of people. I'm not sure how, I think I probably would have been pretty cowed by a yeller and maybe would have slunk off and not taken advantage of the opportunity, but maybe somebody else would be stretched by that. You certainly see, like in sports, where some of the coaches who are pretty rough on their players get really good results. I don't know if they are great examples, but who knows how to make that calculation. Why did you leave and go to Harris?
So I had some personal issues while I was with Joel, and he and I had a very frank conversation about it. And we were gearing up and starting on Obama's reelection campaign. And it was basically like, I couldn't deal. I had a personal tragedy at the time and some health stuff. And my wife was pregnant too. So there was a lot going on. He was very frank with me. We were just like, it's just not a presidential reelection campaign. It's just not the place to be for somebody to go through that much. I did go to Harris, which was a really interesting thing to me because it had the Harris name, which is from Lou Harris, who was a John F. Kennedy's pollster and is considered one of the great grandfathers of political consulting and polling. And although most of the work had become corporate, there still was like a political through line, particularly in the international space. So I still got to do some really interesting political work in places like India and a few places in Europe. So it was a way to still keep my political knife sharp while at the same time getting a very broad exposure to a huge range of corporate and other advocacy clients too. And then at the same time, there was still freelance political work going around as well that I was able to take advantage of too.
Was there disinformation type stuff going on at that point on your radar at all? Or is that a later development?
It's a later development. When we were doing political fights, even in places like India, where you literally have to worry about your staff being beaten on the way to overseeing a poll, almost like America back in the 1840s, where it was sometimes bullets, not ballots type situation, you still didn't have the kind of dedicated disinfo streaming from the top. There were rumors going around that occasionally you figured you had to quash, things like that. I saw something similar working in Ukraine as well. But there wasn't the kind of full-scale, top-to-bottom, nearly everything that's being done to us is disinfo, the way I think it is now in American politics and in so many other democracies across the world.
You were teaching on the side at that time?
Yes. So I was invited to teach statistics for marketing professionals at CUNY, which was, it's always a fantastic way to, one of the things you do in politics is you always worry about young people and how they're voting. So this was a great way for me just to spend time, serious time, with 18, 19, and 20-year-olds and really get a sense for where they were and how they were viewing things. Teaching, I think, should always come naturally to a good consultant. You know, you're essentially teaching your clients. So it was a very natural thing for me to do and a lot of fun as well.
What was the next job after Harris?
So after Harris, I worked for a while with a startup. What we did was there was an economist at a University of Chicago by the name of Glenn Weil, and he had come up, he essentially, to a certain extent, solved for a very tricky problem in how people vote, which is how do you factor in somebody's passion along with them saying yes to a question? And so the classic example is always, you know, when they changed the recipe for Coca-Cola, right? They had this group of people who they could see in focus groups were furious at the idea of getting rid of the traditional Coca-Cola recipe, but they couldn't quantify it. And what happened was when they changed the recipe, this was back in the 80s, that small group of people basically organized themselves and, you know, launched one of the most effective anti-corporate consumer campaigns basically forcing Coke, you know, this massive multi-billion dollar corporation, to revert back to its old formula. And the question that had always been on marketers and pollsters and everyone's minds is, how could you essentially capture that? And what this economist, Glenn Weil, had done is something very simple. He came up with this method called quadratic voting, which is essentially you're assigned a certain number of credits and you can then buy a certain number of votes, but you buy at a quadratic level. So that if you want 2 votes, that's going to cost you 4 credits. If you want 4 votes, that costs you 16. And what we found was that by introducing this sense of scarcity, you got people to really focus on what was most important to them. And you could then find out which issues they were either most passionate about or kind of simply paying lip service to. So what was so cool about that research is, first of all, again, it gave me a window into technology that most of my peers didn't have. We had to take this kind of economic theory and actually embody it in software. And I got to work with some really fascinating folks from Massachusetts Institute of Technology on it. And what we found was it could be even a self-revelatory thing. Like, my wife was one of the first people to go through the UI, and she was like, wow, I didn't know abortion was my number one issue, but it clearly is. We were able to get it to an MVP, and we were actually producing revenue, but the timeline was a little bit too long for me as somebody who now had 2 kids. So what wound up happening with that is the crypto community took it over, and it's now become very fundamental to Vitalik Buterin's plans for Ethereum. We basically kind of signed over all the software and all the patents to open source so they could develop it as much as possible.
Interesting. What was the next job you took that prepared you for what you were doing with We Defend Truth?
I went to work for a digital content shop, which was focused exclusively on content marketing. And what that really opened my eyes to was that these guys had, this was Group SJR, they had been a PR firm, right? And then they transitioned over into content marketing. And the strategic reasons for doing so were extraordinarily instructive to me, because they were like, why depend upon journalists and gatekeepers in order to reach the public when, thanks to digital and thanks to data, we can just buy their eyeballs? We know who we need. We know where they are. We can just go out and purchase that, and we can serve up content that is interesting and exciting to these folks and not have to worry about journalists covering our client or anything like that. We can pretty much buy the scaled audience that we need. And that was eye-opening to me, because coming from a political background, you know, you almost only work through gatekeepers in terms of news. And then, you know, what you do in terms of advertising is supposed to cover the rest of that. But this was a time when most political advertising was concentrated still in that last 2 to 3 weeks before the election actually happened. Whereas content marketing is 24/7, 365 day year thing. And so that, when I saw after 2016, what Brexit and what the Trump folks had done, is they had essentially adopted that content marketing angle, which is like, you know, we don't have to work through the traditional gatekeepers. We have the lists. We have the voter files. We know where these people are. We can just start buying time in front of them on their devices and just start pushing content in front of them and seeing how they react. And I think they even took it to an even higher level than most content marketers were willing to, simply by pushing tons of content through the system almost nonstop, and basically creating this optimizing feedback loop where they were continually learning about what was attractive to which audiences and who they could appeal to with which messages and which content on an ongoing basis. And so their ability to optimize what they were showing to people was just through the roof in terms of outperforming anything that anybody else was doing, including most of my colleagues on the left.
Were you thinking of it at the time through a disinformation lens, or was it Do you think that that was mainly political spin, old style, more or less?
No, I think that I had the same attitude as a lot of folks about disinformation back in 2015, 2016, in that it's bullshit and people will realize it's bullshit. It's insane that they're hanging their hat, you know, on things that are basically lies. The truth will out. What we saw is that not only was it never corrected, and that the press either couldn't correct it because they weren't aware it was going on, or when they did correct it, the horse was already so far out of the barn that there was almost nothing could be done. And I think what was unique about what I was seeing at the time is I understood why they couldn't see it, because we knew as digital content marketers that you picked your audience and that you could do something called negative targeting as well, whereas you have a list of people who you don't want to ever see your content. And the process through which somebody who gets a nasty piece of disinfo in front of them on Facebook could then somehow alert somebody else to that is almost unimaginable, right? It would have to be somebody who has the sophistication to know to take a screenshot, and then they would have to know some journalist's contact information. You know, they would have to know how to connect it to an email. The journalist would have to look at it. And even then, the journalist, even if they were intrigued, would struggle with validating that this was real and that at what scale it was occurring at. So this whole thing about the dark posts and dark that was just the MO for how digital content was being pushed through the system. What I think the Brexiteers and what the Trump people did is they recognized the power of that, that they could push disinfo to folks, and not only would nobody be aware of it who could correct it, but that nobody else would be jumping into those digital bloodstreams to offset it as well.
Was the time at Ketchum valuable to you?
I think anytime you're doing corporate work as a political person, you're getting a lot of insight into how to basically reach out to people. I mean, what I always appreciated about my corporate clients that they know better than political clients is if you can't win the fight over engagement, you might as well not even show up to try and win the fight over messaging. And that's something that corporate work always keeps you acutely aware of, is you really have to find the way to not just find people, but to get them to look at or to read or to view what you're already spending millions of dollars on. So I always found my corporate clients were much savvier and much smarter about the McLuhan thing, about the medium being a big part of the message.
Tell me about Peppercom.
Peppercom is another PR firm. What, again, is great about moving into a corporate world like that, and that was a time where I actually got to build an entire research team from scratch, is that there's these fantastically powerful digital tools that are pretty much only sold to corporate marketers simply because the margins are so much better and the payments are so much more regular too. There's a particular presidential campaign that I'm aware of that will remain nameless who, when I left it, it was still in debt like $300,000. And the guy who I was working for was basically like, yeah, we're never going to see that. So getting paid to do political work, I think has always been a bit of a mug's game. And a lot of the digital vendors who have gone on to do some and create some exceptionally powerful tools, they know to basically only be marketing their stuff to directly to the big corporations or to folks like Peppercom, who are agencies who only work on behalf of corporate clients. So the advantage is there. I got to see huge advancements in things like natural language processing, network analysis, things that have now become crucial to my work way before I think anybody on the political side was ever going to be aware of them.
So what's the founding story for We Defend Truth? Why did you start that and what were you trying to do?
During kind of the post-Trump time, it was almost like on my own, I was working pretty much like by myself to try to show the world that this new model of campaigning that Trump and Brexit had brought to the table was, first of all, not all illegal and unethical, right? There was a lot of things that those guys did that was just smart, that was just plain innovative, and that we could use it for our side effectively. I was able to show through a control trial in the 2017 Alabama race that my theory was correct. And I got to do so again in 2018. But then what happened in kind of come 2019 and 2020 is I started to again have some health problems. And I was really struggling to get any of the work done on my own. But I was approached by a Silicon Valley tech guy who really believed in the work and was really excited about it. And what he offered to do was essentially set me up with kind of like my own pack to run the kind of campaign we wanted to in 2020. And as part of that, he brought on Jimmu Green, who he had connected with, I believe, through Clubhouse. You know, it was a blast from the past with that. I'm not even sure Clubhouse is still around. But he had connected with her on that. And Jimmu and I got along like gangbusters. And we were able to put together enough of a budget to essentially run, again, a campaign in Pennsylvania, again, employing my theories of change. And we ran a randomized control trial this time as well. And again, everything came through exactly as we predicted. The randomized control trial showed many thousands of votes that we were able to push away from Trump. Some went to Biden, some went to essentially being blank, some went to third party. But the power of the theory was once again shown. But once again, there was internal problems that hindered the work. And what they were was essentially the Silicon Valley gentleman was having a hard time playing nicely in the sandbox. And so we kind of had to like cut him out, but he had control of our website and our emails, and he kind of like picked up his balls and went home. You know, so
is that somebody you won't name?
I don't think I should. He tends to be obviously very vindictive. I'd probably prefer not to. But it really hurt us. And it really meant that Jimmu and I had to do a lot of work, not only to reassure our donors, but to kind of keep the effort going. And what our main donor, Albert Wenger, asked us to do was to reincorporate away from a PAC and into a 501c3 nonprofit. And that nonprofit is what became We Defend Truth. The reason why we were able to do that and still be very effective in the way we want it to be effective is because for one of the first times possibly in history, there's an entire political game that's being played right now, which is predicated almost exclusively on disinformation, which shouldn't be surprising to us. Anytime you have an authoritarian or even fascist or fascist adjacent type folks at work, everything they do is disinformation, from the problem that they seem to diagnose, to the solutions that they come up with, to the outcomes that they tell all of us and tell their willing believers to expect. It's all disinfo. There's not a single part of it that's predicated upon truth whatsoever. So what we have consistently found is you can be effective and dangerous to them simply by finding a way to package the truth in a way that makes it digestible to the same folks who are being fed the disinfo. So what our team kind of likes to say is we kind of figure out the chocolate that makes the medicine go down, the medicine in this case being facts and truth. And the chocolate is, what is the kind of content? What is the type of humor? What is the kind of cultural identifier that we need to wrap the truth around in order for it to be attractive and digestible to these folks who are being so badly disinformed, essentially besides us?
One of the things that's interesting about your accounting to me is that you paid so much attention to how the other side was conducting their business. Because one of the things I've noticed in a lot of interviews with progressive operatives of different sorts is that a lot of times we are really working hard on what we do and not that knowledgeable about what the opposing part of the ecosystem is up to. It seems like maybe disinformation is an area where maybe it's more necessary, like in a straight on campaign, opposition research or something, but a lot of kind of categories of political entrepreneurship, people just, they're building software to help with volunteers. They don't even look at what the other side does or whatever it is. Tell me a little bit more about what you were learning and how you were learning by watching the other side.
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think you're totally right. There's too little effort. And we all know it too, right? You know, Facebook, for all its faults, they now have their ad library totally open. So you can go in and take a look very easily at what the other side is doing. And as a campaigner and as a consultant, what you quickly see isn't anything that is going to sound surprising, because it is emotion heavy rather than policy heavy or things like that. And I think the issue is our side is extraordinarily uncomfortable working purely in the emotional realm. We're people who want to go out and win based upon policy. And just the basic fact is folks just don't vote on policy. And if they seem like they do vote on policy, it's very often because that policy is a signifier of deeper values that trigger those kind of emotional connections. So abortion is a great one where I know it seems to a lot of folks that Democrats are winning because of the policy that we push in terms of being pro-choice. But in our qualitative work, what we've consistently found is that abortion is more of a signifier for how much you care about women and their health, right? And so what taking a hard pro-life stance sounds like isn't necessarily upsetting to a woman because you're going to block her from getting an abortion that she definitely wants. What you're actually communicating is, I don't care whether you live or die. I don't care about your health. I care about this religious belief that I have. And by really focusing more on the emotional impact of policy, of the candidates, of what we're pushing or trying to get done, that's where you really start to pull people over. And you see that that's almost like everything the other side does is attempt to push emotional buttons. And I'm not saying like we should slip over 100% to that, but I think that we should be worried about things that run a lot deeper than just policy and messaging, where I think the vast focus of our kind of research and preparation and even execution lie right now.
You mentioned this work you were doing in Pennsylvania and the experiments that you ran to test whether or not it was effective. Can you be more specific about the sort of things that you had people see and what worked?
Yeah, definitely. So one of the things that we've copied from the other side is producing mass amounts of content and pushing that out. The figure I always like to go back to is when people went and took a look at ad libraries for the Trump and Clinton campaigns. I think the Clinton campaign had about 6,000 unique pieces of content in their Facebook library, whereas the Trump team had about 6 million, right? So it's an order of magnitude greater. And what you get with that is a much more nuanced and profound understanding of exactly what is working and exactly what is not. And you get it in real time from real people. So what we did was we created a bunch of different videos, memes, GIFs, websites, and we could essentially rely mostly on Meta, just because going after the kind of voters who are the targets for disinformation, it's a heavy Facebook and Instagram play. And what we could kind of see in real time as we were pushing out different types of content was, okay, well, these two GIFs are doing really well. These memes aren't. Let's strip all of these memes out and let's push more money into the GIFs that are working. And let's go back to our content creators who made those GIFs and get them to make more. And so we were able to discover that this completely non-political guy, Bo Elliott, who had already achieved online fame as the number one GIF maker in Reddit's history, we were able to identify that his GIFs didn't just work on Reddit, that they worked extraordinarily well in these campaign contexts as well. And so we were continually going back to Bo for more GIFs while the campaign was live. And I think that's another big part of the reason why we were able to attract a lot of people. I think it helps to get a little bit technical here. The way most digital campaigns are run is all of the content is dumped into the system, and then you kind of let the system run. And over time, with enough impressions and enough views, the algorithms start to decide which are the best performing and which are not. And the algorithms will kind of naturally start to push for the better performing ones and take away the worst performing ones. What we found is it was a stupid long period of time to wait for the algorithms to take over. What we found was far more effective was to have our ad buyer, Philip Zipman with Outfox. Philip was this guy with like 25 years. Like he'd been working on what was working on the web back in like the 90s. And he had such a great gut instinct for what was working, what wasn't. We were able to shortchange the algorithms by sometimes as many as 10 days. And so what that allowed us to do, again, was a level of optimization and performance that was far beyond what in other campaigns we had to kind of sit around and wait for. So we had this very unique combination of an extremely highly skilled content creator matched against somebody with a really deep experience and amazing gut instinct for, okay, well, these numbers are coming in now. I think that, you know, we either have to wait and the numbers are going to improve, or actually he's like, Phil was like, kind of get it out of there. It's just not going to do anything. So our efficiency of spend was also on another level, I think.
I interviewed Philip Zipman on this podcast back in 2020. I don't think I grasped what he was doing in the context that you're talking about. And I'm really glad to complete that circle right now a little bit. When you think about democracy being conducted through the mechanism of who makes better GIFs or TikTok videos or gets to people when they're streaming some game or just all of the new ways of delivering content and being persuasive or demotivating or motivating or all of the things that one can do with the assistance of computers and the kind of maximization that can happen. Does that leave you as uneasy as it leaves me?
No, look, I mean, there's always been a huge dog and pony show, right, for politics. And we can see that going back in history. I mean, not only to the time where, you know, pamphlets, you know, were or political cartoons against Boss Tweed were so effective, but also up until like Ronald Reagan and his understanding of how to, you know, stage a speech and how to really connect with people and his own use of humor to basically get people comfortable with him and at ease with what was otherwise, you know, a rather extremist candidate at the time. So I think that it's incumbent upon campaigners to just understand that the minute you have a college degree, even in this time where so many people have a college degree, it's only about a third of people who have a four-year BA. You're looking at two-thirds of folks who are undereducated or not as well educated as you are. And you also have to understand that these are folks that have what are actually very rational ways of interpreting the world. And they look at our campaigns in the same way that they look at campaigns from any other corporate, you know, source or from any other even local source. And so they want to see that you understand them and their concerns and their worries and that you're respectful of their culture. One of the things we always do is we do a mapping of the kind of the cultural landscape for the folks who we're targeting so that we're using signifiers to get them to feel comfortable with the message that we're then kind of almost like Trojan horsing in behind it. And this can be anything from, you know, making sure your GIFs are from a show like Yellowstone, right, which is hugely popular among a certain portion of the population, or a show like Blue Bloods, which my East Coast elite circles, nobody watches. But I know for sure that in, you know, hard to reach red districts in Wisconsin is very popular. It's really a matter of meeting people where they are, that our job that we consistently do a really terrible job at. To me, it's a very small ask. It is a little bit frustrating, right? But I think as long as you're working in politics, you just have to acknowledge, you know, that the people you're seeking to convince are not necessarily your own kith and kin, right? And that's one of the criticisms I almost always have when I first start to work with creatives. There's a great line from Mad Men where he says, you know, stop writing for other writers. You know, I have to tell my creatives, stop making content for other liberals. This isn't who we're trying to reach. So it's kind of a yes and no. I feel a lot better about it if the platforms are better about regulating disinfo and hate speech and things like that. That's, I think, the part that genuinely scares me. We just have to admit to ourselves that, you know, we have to get out of our comfort zones if we're actually going to engage with the people who determine the elections in this country.
Can you give me a sense of the scale of your organization over time? Like from the start to this election, how big of an enterprise is it and how much reach have you been able to have?
Well, so we're typically able to reach a few million people with each campaign. Our public education campaigns have included pro-vaccination campaigns, included protecting trans kids by, in the first case, talking to anti-vaxxers. In the second case, reaching out to conservative parents in Texas, you know, about trans issues. So we're looking to impact a few million people with each campaign. I think in 2024, you know, our feeling is that we've proven ourselves, you know, enough that we really need to start looking at this in terms of tens of millions and showing up aggressively for that number of folks in order to really have the impact that we want to.
When I talked to Sasha Eisenberg about the ecosystem that's developed to defend truth and be among with you and lots of other people, he characterized the feeling over time as increasingly discouraged by the fight. Do you put yourself in that category?
I mean, if I were to take a step back, it is discouraging that with this many years, this many campaigns, this much data to prove our theory of change, that we're still struggling to get funded. Honestly, like stepping back for a second, I've never in my life seen any team perform as highly as my team has and still struggle to get funding through the door. I have a sense for why that is. I think it's because, you know, we're kind of out there on our own. And I think that kind of scares donors a bit. Like, if your method is so effective, why are you guys the only ones doing it? But at the same time, I'm like, we've never had a failed campaign. Everything we've always done has been not just successful, but extremely successful. Yeah, it gets a little discouraging, but, you know, at the same time, there was a story from the Vietnam War that's always meant a lot to me. It's about a protester who would show up every day in front of the White House with a candle. I mean, sometimes he'd be joined by hundreds or thousands of people. Sometimes he'd be there by himself. One time a reporter asked him, why are you doing this? Do you really think you're going to change the country? And his response was, oh, I don't do this to change the country. I do this so the country doesn't change me. That's more or less my attitude as well, is that, like, I am in some sense okay with the work that we're doing never getting the recognition that it deserves, because I know it's what's right and it's in line with all of my values and beliefs. And I'm very deeply proud of it as well. I wouldn't want to stop, even though it's been, what, 7-8 years now of just kind of skimping by, living almost like the equivalent for a nonprofit of paycheck to paycheck.
I wish that were not a struggle. I named this podcast The Great Battlefield, took it from Mr. Lincoln. But I think sometimes of two forces arrayed, you could think of it as the parties, but it's really broader than the parties by quite a bit, arrayed against each other. When you think of the balance of power in the information versus disinformation area? How do you think we're matched up at this time?
The straightforward way to answer this is the truth still resonates with people. And I think that's why we're still able to win elections, is because the truth has a resonance to it, it has a depth to it that I do feel like on some level people can sense and appreciate. I think that you have to put billions behind disinfo, and in order for it to really achieve a scale like it's been able to achieve. But we can't sleep on the fact that it's essentially taken over an entire political party in the most powerful country in the world. I mean, we basically have a normal political party, the Democrats, and then we have what's essentially a disinfo party. There's almost nothing that ever comes from the other side that is predicated upon facts, and they openly embrace that. And it's dangerous to the point where they can get to like 45, 46, 47% and then kind of squeeze through in order to actually get into power. And I think that that's partially what's frustrating for me, is that we do have things like the truth and facts on our side. We just don't do what's necessary to push the other side's disinfo back off the battlefield and into the fringes where it belongs and where it's operated for most of history. That's the big opportunity here with this election. The other side is kind of like they've taken off their masks. They've announced open embrace of authoritarianism. And if we can fight it well enough and hard enough, not only can we win and perform well, but we can help consign it back into the dustbin of history as no longer being a way to win. That's the reason why it's been able to attract so many adherents. That's why it's been able to, you know, infect so many of our institutions, because it's now shown itself as a way to win. And the only way to dissuade people from that is basically to force it to lose over and over again, and to convince folks that they have to take another way. They have to adopt a new manner.
It feels like there's a tipping point in some societies where disinformation is the only information, like a Russia. It's close to the only information, right? We are nowhere near that, of course. Do you think that there could come a time where this society went that road?
I think that I would have said no until October 7th of this past year. What I've really been struck by, and I had a long chat with somebody who works in social media for the Israeli Defense Forces, that when Hamas showed up on October 7th, not only were they ready for the on-the-ground military part of it, but they had their information warfare strategy all lined up as well. And we saw the effects of that very, very quickly in, you know, the adoption by the left wing of this country, particularly the far left, of the chosen Hamas narrative within a few weeks. They had the networks picked out, they had the people, they had the content, it was all ready to go, and it was all pushed out in a highly effective and brutal manner that definitely caught Israel off guard, but also caught the rest of us who are basically pro-Israel off guard as well. But that kind of showed me was something that I've always been worried about, which is, you know, disinfo technically doesn't have a political party. When you look at who is susceptible to disinfo, it doesn't go red or blue. There is just as much capacity on the left to fall victim to disinfo as there has been on the right. And I think what has slowed that down is kind of the necessity of having to win election campaigns from the side of the right. And that has kind of slowed down their efforts to pull down the left into this kind of noxious disinfo space as well. But it's theoretically entirely possible. And I feel very strongly that since October 7th, it's now been proven. When I talk to friends of mine on the left, and all I hear about are the murdering of Palestinian children. I get asked how I could support that. And my basic question is always to them, well, what do you think the U.S. was doing to Syrian children and Iraqi children when it was bombing ISIS? Do you think we had like non-children bombs? They're like, well, how could you even bring that up? Like, I'm bringing it up because I personally think that if ISIS had been savvy enough to have photographers and videographers on the ground chronicling what U.S. bombs were doing to those villages, and if they had served them up and shared them out in the way that Hamas has been able to, I now have to question whether or not we could have completed our campaign against ISIS. Because look, you decide to go to war, there are consequences to war, and they're horrifying. But this is the first war I've seen where the worst images that can come out of any war are served up aggressively and constantly in order to shape a narrative that is favorable to one side over the other. And I don't think that's by accident whatsoever. I'm somebody who protested against the Iraq war back in 2003. I've worked repeatedly in elections to try and take down Netanyahu. I consider him one of the worst people on earth. But at the same time, I can't help noticing that a lot of what I'm being personally attacked with by folks is stuff that wouldn't be out there unless somebody had an agenda and was focused in pushing it out. I do think that we're facing potentially really bad times ahead if we can't get our arms around this now and start pushing some of it away and out of the political discourse.
I think I'm going to steer around the Israel-Hamas thing right now because it is a difficult situation, to say the least. I like your notion that the truth has some advantages, because a lot of people have been saying, you know, lies travel quicker, disinformation has some advantages in how it spreads, and there's sort of a relief to thinking, oh yeah, maybe there are some advantages the truth might actually have in the world. Can you tell me a little more about how you think about that?
Yeah, what we generally find, right, is that the reason why disinfo is being pushed is for purposes of destabilization. You can destabilize a coalition, you can destabilize a country's populace by basically attacking with disinfo. And, you know, the advantage that we have as the stabilizers is the fact that in general, folks are not big fans of instability. They don't like feeling that the ground is shaking out from underneath them. In our work that we want to do this cycle, you know, we call it playing offense and defense. On the offensive part is going after the authoritarians. What an authoritarian has to push in order to succeed is things are awful. Things are so bad. Things have gotten so wrecked that you need to elect me a strong man who can, you know, sweep in there and really, you know, bash skulls together and set things aright. Even people who are predisposed to authoritarianism don't necessarily like to hear that their institutions and, you know, the America that they've always believed in is coming apart so horribly. Equally, another thing we want to do is basically push the truth behind the lawsuits and indictments that are going against Trump as being perfectly valid and legitimate cases of the law being broken. Because again, people don't necessarily want to believe that all of a sudden our judiciary is being leveraged to destroy somebody for political purposes. On the defensive side of things, it's also very similar, right? We have a break right now in our coalition between young progressives and Jews. And healing that break, healing that separation is something that people kind of naturally are drawn to because it's a comfortable place for them to be, because young progressives and Jews, you know, have fought together for, you know, decades now, if not longer. Similarly, the other place we want to play defense and heal folks and heal the coalition on is when it comes to suburban parents who are being told these awful trans agenda folks are coming in to convert their kids over to these degenerate way of lives, parents don't want to think about that stuff either, right? They want to hear that this is purely a bullshit political attack. They want to know that, you know, the trans agenda is not real, that nobody's coming after their children, that trans kids are just the same as their kids in terms of needing safety and needing to be protected. So we have that going for us in that we are stabilizers. We're almost conservative in the sense that we're the ones who want to keep things as they are. It's the disinfo folks who are going after the destabilization of all of those things. And I think that is what makes, you know, what we're pushing very naturally attractive. The disinfo guys, they have to sell you on the fact that the world is on fire. All we have to do is show you that it isn't. And I think that we're the ones who have a much more powerful case to make, not only when it comes to data, but also when it comes to what people kind of naturally long for, you know, which is that kind of stability. I always say people hate politics, man. Like, they just hate it. I like the fact that Biden didn't show up to do the Super Bowl interview. I think it's savvy. You know, people love the fact that they don't have to think about Biden every day. We always saw in our focus groups that even some of Trump's supporters were like, I hate the fact that I have to think about this guy 4 or 5 times a day. It's exhausting. I don't think that's where people want to spend their mental energy. And I think that's the role we play.
You know, there's this notion of paid media and earned media in campaigns. You're talking to some extent about paid disinformation. It seems like Trump is really good at earned disinformation. Like, he can get the attention cheaply by tweeting or the equivalent and or being interviewed. And he can take a significant proportion of the population and teach them that he didn't lose an election that he actually lost. And then that gets amplified through other channels as well and by other people who also can earn their time in our faces. When you think about that power to have a liar at the top of one of the hills here, does that change the calculus about how to fight it at all?
That's a great question. Fundamentally, no, right? Like, disinfo is disinfo no matter how you're hearing it. And people are definitely not sophisticated enough, nor should they be, to distinguish between paid and earned. You know, something we always see in our research is when we talk to folks about ads on Facebook or on Instagram, they'll be like, oh, well, I don't think I get those. My Facebook and Instagram are set to, they're apparently, I never see ads. And it's like, you do see ads. It's just that Facebook and Instagram and Google and all the rest of those guys have invested billions in making sure the ads on their platforms don't look like ads. So it's really a nuance, I think, that marketers and campaigners have that the audience really doesn't. You know, I was going to say before, is when you have an entire political movement that's now flipped itself over into being a purely a disinfo effort. It's frustrating, but it should also make obvious what we need to do in terms of building that digital ally for the truth in order to counter that, and that there is an audience for that and an audience need for that as well. The other thing that I've always been impressed with Trump about is that they do run a very simultaneous paid and earned campaign. So when Trump is speaking, he's trying out a lot of different, you know, little nuances, changes in phrase and things, seeing how the audience reacts to it. And then if there's something that they react to well, it gets transformed into content that is then pushed out digitally. But there's the reverse of that happening as well. There's digital content that they are paying to push out, and that if something pops or something does really well there, they then feed up top. Best example of this was Drain the Swamp. Trump was very resistant to incorporating that into his rallies and into his speeches, but the digital guys working for him could see how well Drain the Swamp was performing. And, you know, Trump was willing to listen to the data. And I say that laughing because, you know, we've all worked with political candidates who, no matter how much data was behind something, would refuse to adopt it. So I was almost kind of jealous, you know, of the Trump team there. But yeah, he was willing to pick that up because, you know, in their paid, they were seeing it do so well. So it's a very nimble and therefore very smart way to approach, because again, you get that kind of always on optimization that I think most campaigns just completely lack.
When you look forward to this particular 2024 election, if you have the ear of the Biden folks or other players on our side that are trying to win, what would you tell them that they should do?
I'd say engagement overall. I'd say
just, what does that mean exactly?
It means capture the eyeballs before you can worry about persuading the hearts or minds. I tend now to think in terms of not just hearts and minds, but eyeballs, hearts and minds. And I think that the smartest way to get eyeballs is to go to the folks who are already getting those, right? Like my favorite content creators to work with are people who have proven themselves on a platform that they are capable of winning the attention game. They're capable of winning eyeballs, because that's where really the true battle is these days when it comes to digital.
So there's a lot of people now who are in the influencer connecting, trying to connect influencers to progressive campaigns. For example, there's some businesses that have sprung up doing, is that the kind of category that you're talking about?
Yeah, I think it's one of many. And I do think it's a really smart one. I would worry so much less about, you know, what message the influencers are taking. I'd worry far more about who the influencers are. There's a lot of bad ways to pull in influencers. And the only smart way to do it is that they are already influential. They can already talk to people to whom you need to talk to. And the other thing I would point out is one of the genius parts about what the Trump team did is they would look at a group like, say, Black women and say like, okay, 96% of Black women aren't going to vote for us. But that means there's 4% who are. So how do we take that 4% and move it to 5% or 6%, right? And by stripping off these like little bits off all of these groups who normal campaigns would say are, you know, verboten or are impossible to grab, you're able to piece together very novel coalitions that you wouldn't have otherwise. It's something that I feel like they've proven out and that we've proven out, that you can reach into like some of the hardest territories, the most pro-authoritarian, pro-fascist circles, and actually start to break folks away from that and off of those beliefs, and therefore like really start to maximize impact.
It's very counter to the people who think of this as who can mobilize more of their already safe supporters, I guess. And I suspect that I'm for doing both. That's kind of the necessity. Is there a question I should have asked you that I failed to?
No, not necessarily. What we've covered and what we're facing and what we've discussed that we're facing going into this year, I think you've said it before, it's a real potential tipping point. And it's really calling upon all of us to kind of raise our game and understand the stakes of what's really at hand. You know, there is a playbook, right, in place that they have for authoritarian takeover of a republic. And anybody with their eyes open can see that that authoritarian playbook is being executed upon. And at the same time, right, part of what we're doing is we're bringing in the folks who overthrew Milosevic in 2003 and developed a playbook for how to fight authoritarianism and how to defeat it and how to keep it out of your politics on an ongoing manner. I hope we wake up to the fact that as many things as we're terrified of, there's also many things that are creating new opportunities for us if we can be nimble enough and innovative enough to grasp them and to exploit them.
Boy, I hope we can. Really appreciate you taking the time. Anything else you want to say?
No, I appreciate this. You got a great podcast. It's real honor for me to be on it. Thank you, Nathaniel.
Thank you. That was David. He is at WeDefendTruth.org. This is Nathaniel G. Perlman with the Great Battlefield Podcast. You can find us at greatbattlefield.com or by searching for Great Battlefield in places where podcasts are found. The Great Battlefield is now part of the Democracy Group Podcast Network. Visit democracygroup.org to learn more about other podcasts that cover democracy and civic engagement. You can also help me by leaving comments and good ratings on Apple Podcasts or elsewhere, and by sending me suggestions for great guests to nperlman@gmail.com.